Good evening, and welcome to tonight's program, hosted by the Oshman Family JCC and the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. My name is Steve Wright, and I'm a member of the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley Advisory Council. It's now my pleasure to introduce Robert Lang, a physicist, laser patent holder, and world-renowned origami artist and authority. Don't you love the blend of those accomplishments? Not too many people have that. Robert has been an avid student of origami for over 40 years and is now recognized as one of the world's leading masters of the art, with over 500 designs cataloged and diagrammed. He is noted for designs of great detail and realism and includes in his repertoire some of the most complex origami designs ever created. Robert also is one of the pioneers of cross-disciplinary marriage of origami with mathematics. Before deciding to devote himself to origami full-time, Robert worked as a physicist, an engineer, and R&D manager, during which time he authored or co-authored over 80 technical publications, and he has 50 patents awarded or pending on semiconductor lasers, optics, and integrated optoelectronics. In a nutshell, he's a Silicon Valley guy to the 10th power. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Robert Lang.
Thank you, Steve.
Robert, you were telling me earlier about an exciting origami exhibit in Taiwan that you just came back from. I believe it's called Origami Universe. I think our audience here in Palo Alto would love to hear about it because you talked to me about how noteworthy it was for this time and place in origami.
Yeah, Origami Universe is an exhibition now at the Chimay Museum in Taiwan, Taipei. And it's one of the largest that's ever been created, and I think probably the most spectacular, not because I'm in it, but because 50 origami artists and over 400 works are in it. Artists and works from all over the world, and Chimay is a very, very nice museum. So I think it's sort of established that origami as an art form now plays on the international stage.
Uh-huh. And how many pieces do you have showing there, and roughly is there a category?
I've got about 16 in the exhibit, roughly evenly divided by things from the natural world, animals, which are very much a favorite of mine, and then also a lot of geometric pieces, some tessellations that are based on tilings, and some geometric pots, similar to pottery, but made from paper and or folded wood.
Mm-hmm. Great, thank you. For those of you who might be interested in seeing that, you know, if you Google origami in Taiwan, you'll basically get hooked up. You'll get a link to it. It really is a spectacular exhibition. Before we leave the global world of origami, Robert, I want to ask you a little more specifically about the kind of travel and for both exhibits and lectures that you do. I know you travel the world, and I wonder whether there is a country maybe that you visited that you were surprised to see the level of origami interest. So maybe just give us around the globe. How is the life of origami today?
Origami, even though it started as this Japanese art, really has become worldwide. And when I've traveled, I've gotten to see origami from a broader array of countries that I've actually been to. And you might not expect origami from places like Vietnam or South America, but there are world-class origami artists in both of those places. It's all over Europe. England, France, Germany all have active origami organizations, world masters, and very distinctive art.
Great, thank you. And I noticed we have several students in the room today. It's great to see you. And so I want to ask you now, Robert, a little bit about, or maybe you can give us the Cliff's Notes of how you became interested in origami yourself. How did it begin for you?
For me, I started at the age of 6. I found some instructions in a book and folded them because it was an interesting puzzle to pass the time. And then because all I needed for origami was a sheet of paper, I could fold those things over and over at any time. And I could play with it, try to modify it, and do them over and over. So it provided a lot of entertainment just from those first few pieces. My parents saw that I was into this paper folding thing, so they fed the obsession by buying me books for birthdays and the like, and that was pouring gasoline on a flame. So that fired a passion in childhood that's carried with me my whole life.
Do you remember what some of those first, what were some of the first folding objects that you remember besides a paper airplane?
Yeah. So I remember the first four pieces, the ones that were in that original book. And there was the traditional Japanese flapping bird, the traditional Japanese frog, a design called the talking crow, which is based on the cootie catcher that a lot of people know how to fold. And the last one was a spider that I've actually not seen all that common, but it's made similar to the frog by cutting each of the legs in half to get eight legs for a spider.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Do you still have any of those?
I don't have any of the ones, those first four, but I do have a few pieces that I folded back when I was about 10 or 11.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's great. I'd like to ask you now about, you mentioned that you got into it as a way to kind of pass time and it became a challenge. But was there anything that got your, about, what is it about origami that got your creative juices flowing?
Well, there was some appeal as a kid to being able to make many different figures. And in a way, it was a way to make toys. You know, I could play with little armies of animals and the like. And I wanted to fold everything that was possible, fold everything in each book. And when I exhausted all the books I could either had from gifts or could find at the local library, there were animals I still wanted to make that I couldn't find any instructions for. So I'd try to make them myself by modifying things I already knew how to do or looking for principles that I could adapt in different ways. Of course, I didn't use that language at the time, but that's what I was doing. And I found I had a little bit of a knack for it. So then the goal of creating new figures kind of became a very satisfying thing in and of itself.
And then it seems that based on your educational career, your interest in math and science was also part of your childhood. And I'm kind of wondering how those two blended, when they started blending together.
The blending happened in college, but it didn't happen until after an independent parallel track. I got interested in math in high school, not, I should say, from my high school courses in math, but through recreational mathematics, the books of Martin Gardner, which I discovered, and that fired a love and passion for mathematics. That love of math, participation in math, being on the math team in my high school, because it was more like recreational math, led me down a technical path in college. I went to Caltech, eventually ended up in electrical engineering because I got to make things in electrical engineering. And that led me into a career in lasers and optoelectronics. But it did something else that was really useful, because it gave me the tools to analyze things mathematically and kind of a conceptual toolkit that if you can develop a mathematical description of a field, then you can use the tools of mathematics to accomplish what you want in that field. And that works in lasers. By developing mathematical descriptions of lasers, I could design better, more powerful, more pure lasers. But the same approach felt like it would work for origami, that if I could develop a mathematical description, it would allow me to create the types of origami figures that I wanted to create. And it did. So by the end of the college, I was bringing those two threads together.
Uh-huh. And then how did you decide, here you are now in college and later, but you had eventually had 50 patents to your name. You had the PhD in physics from Caltech. You're working in these exciting fields of both lasers you know, and fiber optics. I think at one time you were even an editor at the Journal of Quantum Electronics. And then how did you decide to leave an exciting Silicon Valley career, because you were working right here in Silicon Valley, to become a full-time paper folder? And what did your wife say?
Yes, why chuck a career for paper folding? Well, origami and lasers were pretty independent. I mean, lasers was my job and livelihood, so I worked first for NASA, JPL in Southern California, and then got lured up here, as so many do, to Silicon Valley to join what was then a small company, Spectradiode Labs, which over the next 10 years or so became a somewhat larger company. And then it got bought by an even larger company, and then it started becoming smaller again, as so often happens in Silicon Valley. But during that time, I had been pursuing an origami career on nights and weekends, and I had written a lot of books and had established a little bit of a reputation in the world of origami. And throughout that whole 10-year career, I had an idea for a book that I wanted to write that was how to design origami. Most origami books are recipe books. You follow the instructions and you end up with a copy of whatever was in the book. But I wanted to teach people how to do what I had done, which was to be able to choose what you want to make and design it. And I thought that I could. And I made abortive attempts at writing that book several times over that decade, but never could really make headway. And I finally came to the conclusion that the reason I couldn't was that in order to write that book, I needed to focus on it to the exclusion of everything else. And I couldn't do it nights and weekends. I couldn't put it aside Monday morning and pick it up again Friday night. So that led to a big question for me. I decided if I was ever going to write the book, I'd have to quit whatever I was doing and write the book. So do I take the red pill or do I take the blue pill? And I decided whatever I had done in lasers and optics, there are lots of great physicists in the world who would be doing great things. They wouldn't miss me. But I felt like I was the only person who could write that book. So I did quit my job and decided to write that book, and I did. And at the same time, I thought, while I'm doing that, I'll try to follow up on all those leads for other work involving origami that I never really was able to follow up on. Uh-huh. And that all paid off. So as it turned out, I never had to go back. That was in 2001.
Right. And what was the essence of that book?
It was how to design origami. It's called Origami Design Secrets. Mm-hmm. The first edition was 580 pages, and the second edition is now 700. And so if you see people walking around sort of bent over, it's because they're carrying that book. But it has kind of become the reference for designing, and I have lots of friends and people I've known who have used it to design. And I think the best feedback one can get as a teacher or a writer of such a book is when you see your students doing things better than you, or things that you wish you had done, and you can enjoy that vicariously and say, well, he learned it from me.
Yeah, that's great. So you of course you had patents and stuff to establish your career in lasers, etc. What was there a particular piece of origami that you think really established you on the origami art scene?
There was one that kind of made a bit of a splash. It actually goes back to my postdoc. I did a postdoc in Germany. Had a lot of time to spare in Germany during the evenings, and I spent a lot of it trying to make a origami version of the cuckoo clocks that I'd seen in the Black Forest. So I did a Black Forest cuckoo clock from a single sheet of paper. It has leaves, pine cone weights, deer's head, cuckoo, clock face, and took about 3 months of evenings to work that out and fold it. But when I came back and published it in Origami Circles, it made a little bit of a splash because it was by about a factor of two more complicated than anything that had been published up to that point.
Uh-huh. And tell us a little bit about the design process for that. Were you then by then applying your mathematical computations in order to plot that out? I mean, where were you with designing that?
I was using a lot of the mathematical concepts, not yet explicitly writing equations, but rather using geometric shapes to represent the building blocks of the pattern. So, for example, I knew that to make the leaves, I wanted to create an arrangement of squares of creases running down the two sides of the strip of paper that I was folding. And so I knew how to represent different shapes in the folded state by different patterns of creases, and I'd assemble those together. And that is mathematical, but it wasn't yet as formal as writing equations. That was, at that time, I was starting to think about the equations, but it was another 5 or 6 years before I could figure out precisely the equations one needed to solve.
So geometry was key, though, for that initial math part of it. You know, I heard somebody before we came on stage today ask you about what kind of math he should be concentrating on if he's interested in origami design. Do you mind talking a little bit about what you recommended and the fact that you've already written a way to do that?
Sure. I'm going to preface it by saying, because people get scared of math, by saying you can design amazingly complex things without ever writing a letter or algebra or plus sign or any formal math.
Sign me up.
Many people design origami just using mathematical ideas, which we can think about in non-mathematical terms of like packing different shapes in a box. That's the type of math that is all one might need to design incredibly complicated shapes. But if you want to study a little bit more formal description of origami, and indeed to solve for some of the more abstract and geometric shapes, then you do need formal math. And the ones I recommended were geometry, trigonometry, and linear algebra to start with. That's kind of advanced high school level, maybe early college level, but just armed with those, you can accomplish a lot.
That sounds achievable, at least for me. But let's skip ahead now, because it's been 30 years or so since the cuckoo clock is how time flies, right? And you're now also being able to blend your science and engineering background and to bring it into the technology world. And I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about the principles of origami that you've been able to use in technology and what's really surprised you about it.
Yeah, one of the pleasant surprises of the origami career has been how applicable origami ideas and concepts are to engineering problems that get encountered in really diverse fields: cars, medicine, space. And the thing that brings origami into it is when some aspect of the technology requires sheet-like material to form a different shape. It might be because you're trying to make a part from sheet stock for manufacturability, and then you'd like to fold it up. Or it might be because the object needs to stow into a small size and then deploy later into a larger size. A lot of space applications are things that are big and flat: antennas, solar arrays, lenses, optics for telescopes, that need to stow smaller to fit into a rocket and then get larger and flat when they get to the destination. And origami, interpreted broadly as folding, provides a controlled deterministic way of making that transition between the flat and the folded states. And the concepts and structures in origami, in some cases, structures that have been known for years only in the origami world, very often can provide the solution needed by scientists and engineers. Mm-hmm. And because I come from an engineering background, lasers and optics and the like, I at least knew the language to talk to engineers, even if I didn't know the specific field. And in some cases, for things like that are optical, like telescopes, I even knew a little bit of the specific field.
Mm-hmm. And name one or two of the projects that has, or the technology that has kind of blown your mind that these two things have come together.
Well, one of the most surprising and one of the earliest was airbag design in cars. We have airbags. Airbags need to inflate and protect the passenger in a crash, and they need to do so under a lot of different circumstances, different impact speeds, different size passengers. And this is addressed by simulating the airbags. But in the early airbag simulators, they had a problem that they needed to develop an algorithm, a recipe, for flattening the airbag inside the simulation. Didn't know how to do it. But it turns out the algorithm you need for flattening an airbag is very closely related to the algorithm you need for flattening for folding an origami crease pattern into an insect-like structure. And so we were able to adapt these patterns called molecules from origami insect design into airbag simulation software.
Wow. Well, and I know that the National Science Foundation has recently not only woken up, but has really wanted to see origami be part of some of the projects that it funds. And I know you're involved in three or four that it's funding and working with some university research teams. Can you tell us a little bit about the work for that?
Sure. And this was amazing to have something like this drop into my lap. About 4 years ago, the National Science Foundation put out, among their many calls for research proposals from universities, one that called for applications of origami or folding broadly. And they urged the teams to develop teams of multiple universities and to team up with an origami artist or an artist of some sort. And at that point, my phone started ringing off the hook. And I ended up with working on four of these projects, at Brigham Young University, University of Massachusetts Amherst, Northeastern University, and Washington State and Caltech. Very diverse projects. The BYU project is working on compliant mechanisms, meaning mechanisms that move by flexing rather than by separate pin joint parts. And as one example that's come out of that, the teams have developed micromanipulators for surgery, compatible with the Da Vinci robot system. So making little tiny origami pincers that can go in through laparoscopic surgery and grab or manipulate the thread or needle to perform surgery. The University of Massachusetts group, which also works with Cornell and Western New England University, developed a technology for creating extremely small folded structures that self-fold in response to temperature and being in an aqueous environment in water. So you can take a fold pattern, perform photolithography, and make something that folds up that is under a millimeter in size. So they've made folded structures that can literally sit on the end of a hair. And these sorts of things have applications in medicine and biology, you know, to make boxes that hold drugs and open up and things like that.
Wow. So it seems like it's a whole new spectrum then in terms of origami. But let me turn now back to your original artwork, because we have some of it here in the room, and just the logistics of transporting some of your material made it so that we brought in certain sized objects. Can you tell the group here about maybe what the largest piece that you've completed and a little bit about it, including how big the paper was and so forth?
Sure. The largest thing that I've folded was a pteranodon, which is a flying not actually a dinosaur, but like a dinosaur, flying creature from the age of the dinosaurs, 14-foot wingspan, and it was folded from about a 16-foot square of paper. The paper had to be custom made, and it was done for a museum, the Redpath Museum of Natural History in Montreal. And if you ever get a chance to go to that museum, go in the door and look up, and you'll see this giant origami creature flying overhead.
And so tell us a little bit how you fold a 16-foot piece of paper. Do you wear knee pads, or are you...
It's pretty strenuous. You know, I take off my shoes, so I'm walking around on the paper in socks, and I do wear knee pads because you're crawling around, and I've often thought after folding one of these giant things that I need to create my own line of exercise videos because it's so strenuous. And it's interesting that you have to develop new folding sequences because with a small piece of paper, you can kind of grab several different points at once and bring them together. But with a giant sheet, you can only grab one point at a time because you walk over, you grab a corner, you lift it up, you walk back, set it down. Then you have to walk back to the fold and start flattening the fold. But before you do, you have to walk back to the corners to make sure they're still aligned. And so something that takes you 3 or 4 seconds when you're doing it on a small size can take several minutes for just that one step when it's giant. So this pteranodon, which I could fold small in about 45 minutes, took a total of 5 days of folding when I did it in Montreal.
Wow. And so when you fold on a project like that, is how do you avoid repetitive stress injury? I mean, how do you keep your fingers limber?
Well, one of the nice things about origami is it does provide a lot of exercise for your fingers. So my fingers are in pretty good shape, but it's also not very repetitive. You're constantly doing different positions. You're not folding the same thing over and over most of the time. Now, some of the time you're folding a fish with 400 scales or a snake with 1,000 scales, then you're doing the same thing, but that's rare. So most of the time your motions are very diverse, and so I've never really had any problems with repetitive strain injuries.
Okay, great. Another one of the pieces you brought today is a koi that's made with what looks like very colorful paper. Can you tell us a little bit about the process for that, including the paper development and so forth?
Yes, the paper is paper that I commissioned. And I commissioned the paper with the koi and indeed the exhibition that it's part of in mind. The vision I had was a wall of koi, and I wanted to come up with a fish design that showed off the paper. The paper was made by the Origami Dough Studio in Haverhill, Massachusetts. It's run by Michael LaFosse, who's a master papermaker and a master origami artist. And I folded from his papers for years. I love his papers. I love the feel. I love the colors, the textures. And so I wanted to do something that actually showed off the paper. And I had the idea, let's do a wall of koi where every piece of paper would be a unique pattern, unique fold, just like a pond full of koi, the pattern is unique to every fish. So I worked with Michael to commission the paper. We did a run of about 100 sheets, custom made, everyone colored individually, and with the color in the paper, not separately painted, throwing handfuls of colored pulp into the bath as we pulled the individual sheets. And the result was 100 sheets of paper, which I folded into a total of about 70 koi, 60 of which are now part of a traveling exhibition filling up a wall.
Yeah, what is the general dimensions of that particular piece?
So the individual koi are about the size of what you see over there at the exhibition. They are about a foot long, but the overall wall of koi is about 40 feet long, 9 feet high.
Wow. And it's beautiful if you see a picture of it. It really is nice. What so far has been your most challenging piece?
Most challenging piece is, well, actually, the most challenging piece is one of the many I haven't succeeded at yet, or designs that are still in progress. But the most challenging one that I've actually succeeded at is one that I just completed this year for an exhibition at the Huntington Library and Gardens in Southern California. And it's a cactus, but it's a cactus that has spines. In fact, it has about 400 spines. And it's all folded from a single uncut square. And this took about 7 years from the time I started folding to the time I finished. Now, that wasn't seven solid years of folding, but it was 7 years off and on, folding a little bit, then putting it aside because I said, this is too much work. There's no way I'll ever finish it. Eventually, I did, and so it's now on display in that show.
It's good that you said that was really one sheet of paper, because I know when some people look at origami, they think, yeah, maybe there's two or three sheets. Is a definition that it needs to be one sheet, two sheets okay in certain circumstances? What do you
say? There's no formal rules for origami or formal definition. The definition that I like is a form of sculpture where folding is the primary means of creating the shape. And there's a lot of latitude in that. And we kind of need a lot of latitude to pick up all of the historical forms of origami, which used cuts, which used multiple sheets, which used non-square paper. But most origami today is from a single uncut square. There are a couple of styles of origami, one called modular origami, one called composite, where people do use multiple sheets. The difference between the two, modular uses many identical units that come together in some sort of a ball. Composite is more in the traditional style of foldings, let's say, the front half of an animal from one sheet, the back half from another. But most people, and most forms of origami that you find today, is a single square, and that's most of what I fold.
It's a single square.
Yeah. Everything over on the display is a single sheet. Not all of them square. Some of them are from rather irregular patterns, but they're all from a single sheet.
I want to go back for a second to the kind of the more science-oriented aspect of origami, because I remembered a question I had from doing a little research for this, and that is that there is now there's origami at the molecular level and the DNA level. Can you, if you're familiar with it, can you tell us about how that is coming to be?
Sure. You know, when we use origami in engineering, we're not using paper, we're using other materials. And so applying the word origami is somewhat metaphorical. We're folding. And we can fold lots of things. But at the very smallest size, it's possible to fold DNA molecules. And about 10 years ago, Paul Rothman, the scientist at Caltech, developed the technique of how to fold DNA molecules. And he folded many, many shapes. And if you do a little internet searching, you can find some of these folded structures. You can do atomic force microscopy on DNA and actually see what these patterns look like. But this started a field that has now grown to include research all around the world. And while the first folded DNA things were maybe a little frivolous, things like triangles and a smiley face or a map of North America, the modern DNA folding is now being applied to applications. Just this past year, a professor at Ohio State named Carlos Castro demonstrated folding DNA around an anti-cancer drug that shields it as it travels through the body, but then cancer cells take up the drug, unfold the DNA, and ooh, surprise, it's an anti-cancer drug, and they die. So this is an example of folding origami, and indeed the specific folding DNA, having real-world practical applications.
That's just amazing. and I knew being here in Palo Alto and in Silicon Valley that we would get a question like this next one, and so I really appreciate it. The question from somebody in the audience is, protein folding is the prediction of the 3D shape that a linear chain will fold into. Are origami principles applicable to this problem?
Yeah, that's a good question, and protein folding is similar to DNA folding in that it is folding a 1D chain. So there are some principles of folding that carry over and that can be used to describe it. But there are also differences. There are things you can do with a 2D sheet that you can't in 1D and vice versa. For example, in 1D, you can have knots. You can tie a string into a knot, but there's not an equivalent structure when you're working with a 2D sheet. So some principles carry over, but some are different.
You know, some of the audience questions are a version of one that I also wondered about, which is all artists have a toolkit. It might be their paintbrushes. For you, I'm sure it's paper. But what are some of the key tools that you have in your toolbox?
I have two kinds of tools in my toolbox, and some of them are physical, for manipulating really tiny things like insect legs, I'll use tweezers. For some of my patterns, especially things that are non-paper, I use a scoring tool. I use a laser cutter programmed to score rather than to cut the paper. And these are kind of what you might think of as tools. I also think of the overhead light, my desk, and the lens machines that sit on my nose for close-up work now that I'm 55, as tools. And those are tools as well. But an equally important set of tools are the ideas, the concepts, the mathematical tools, or the understanding of geometric shapes. The origami artists of 50 years ago didn't have those tools. They certainly had tweezers and desk lights and reading glasses. But the mental tools are just as important, perhaps even more important, and they're vital to what I do, both in art and in the applications to technology.
So a follow-up question, again from the audience, is what is now possible that wasn't possible because of the mathematical applications, the use of scoring, et cetera?
There's two classes of things that are possible. One is the complexity of an artistic design. We can go to much higher complexity and be assured that it's going to work. You know, if you're folding something that's going to take 10, 20, or 40 hours, you want it to work on the first try. And using the mathematical tools, we can be assured that the pattern we design will fold up and will work on the first try. And in a way, that has given us the confidence to take on these more complicated goals because we know that we'll be able to succeed at them. But also, the things that are more abstract, geometric, three-dimensional, a lot of those can only be designed mathematically. That is, that their fundamental description is a bunch of interlinked equations that we can't solve just applying our intuition. But simply by setting those equations up in a little program, we can say run and boom and get the answer. And therefore get a crease pattern that folds into the 3D shape that we're trying to achieve.
Mm-hmm. And that leads to another science question, which is also, I think, relevant here in Silicon Valley. But what do you think are the unsolved problems in the science of origami? I mean, what are there one or two things that you wish you could solve if you knew how to do A, B, C?
There's actually a lot of them. I'll mention what seems to be a universal solution for if you're given a description of a surface in, let's say, a triangulation of a surface, then there is an origami algorithm that can give you a crease pattern that folds into that exact surface. Okay, that's all well and good. But what we don't want an exact solution. We want an efficient, elegant solution. So we want a pattern that is simpler than that exact solution, but still approximates, still comes close, but takes advantage of geometric coincidences and things where the eye can be fooled by, let's say, a curved surface instead of a whole bunch of little facets that required lots and lots of folds. So that's kind of sitting on the borderline of applying art to solving the problem. So I guess I would summarize the answer to that is an unsolved problem is algorithms that give elegant and beautiful patterns and not just an exact solution for the thing you plugged in.
So if we check back with you in a year, you'll have that solved?
A year might be too soon, but I would bet not, and check back not just with me, but with some of the many people who are now doing algorithmic origami, folks like Professor Eric Demain at MIT, Tomohiro Tachi at University of Tokyo, and many others. Tachi, in fact, is the one who came up with the algorithm I just described. Hmm. There's power in numbers, and the power in origami is that we have many people now investigating these different aspects of it. We share ideas, we share hunches, share approaches, and that spirit of sharing and collaboration is what I think ultimately will get us to the solution.
Thank you. And, you know, you mentioned during these past couple of questions about the intuitive artist and there's also the algorithmic origami. When you started out on this 40 years ago, there wouldn't have been the math and laser scoring. But how have these two different kinds of artists blended together? How has the origami world greeted what is, for lack of a better term, say, another set of hands?
In different ways. The origami world is diverse. There are people who just want to focus on the art and really have no interest in exploring mathematical approaches. Just, it's not fun for them. And those that are, and people who have a little more mathematical bent or like solving puzzles tend to be a little more receptive to the mathematical techniques. And I don't want to, I wouldn't disparage someone for not adopting math, because in some cases, some of the best folders I know have such an incredible intuition, they don't need math. They just understand where the paper goes and how to make folds, and they fold things that I think are mathematically beautiful, but they would say, no, I don't use math, I just know this is where it needs to be. I actually view math as a tool for those of us, myself included, whose intuition doesn't take us to where we want to go, but math gets us over the hurdle, lets us complete the last step to achieve the artistic goal. And that's the thing in the art world, that we're all motivated by some artistic vision, and we'll use whatever path works for our tool set, our aptitude, our desires. Mm-hmm. And it may be intuition, it may be math, or it may be a blend of the two.
Okay. But in general, how about collectors? Are collectors equally excited about the intuitive artist as well as
the
algorithmic one?
Yeah, the collectors who I talk to or who collect my work or who collect other people's works, I don't think they're motivated by, they care whether the person uses math. They're motivated by the artwork, and they don't care how it was created. If it's beautiful and if it speaks to them, then they want to buy it.
Great. Beautiful. Here's an audience member question, which is there a formal ranking system for origami artists? And I guess more specifically, how is one determined to be a master?
There isn't a formal ranking system. And I think that's great, because there's nothing to fight over. There's very little to fight over. So most of the origami masters in the world today are on pretty good terms with each other. We're friends. We share ideas. There's certainly a little bit of competitive feeling. Like you see someone fold something great, and you go, wow, that's really good now. I wonder if I can top that somehow. But it's a friendly kind of competition. And I think if there were a formal ranking system, then we'd have something to fight over and be snippy. And while we're all human, there's a little bit of that everywhere, but way less in the world of origami. And I hope it stays that way.
Yeah, great. You and I have had this discussion about how do you measure the amount of work that goes into an origami object. And this question will allow you to address that. How many folds were in your biggest project?
I get that question a lot. Mm-hmm. And the short answer is I don't know, because I don't keep track of it. But I want to give kind of an analogous question for painting. If you ask a painter, how many brush strokes were in that painting? They don't know, because it's not something they keep track of. And indeed, when you're in the zone, you know, you're not going 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, whatever. You're just letting your hands do what they need to do to create the shape. And in many cases, that's the way it is with origami.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Now I want to talk a little bit about paper, because you mentioned the paper that you commissioned, and of course we see several different examples of paper in every bit of origami. Talk to us about what those of us who don't know the intricacies of paper. I won't call them tricks, but some of the ways paper can be manipulated to make it easier to fold. A couple of those things.
Yeah, paper matters a lot. And in fact, I think the development of so-called super complex origami, the most complex origami, wouldn't have happened if people hadn't also either developed or discovered papers that could tolerate super complex folding. So what are the properties of the papers? They need to be usual for the most complex pieces. They need to be really thin and really strong. And to be really strong, they need to have very, very long fibers. That usually means non-wood-based paper, because wood pulp papers tend to have very short fibers because the wood fibers are very short. So we use so people look at papers that are made from alternate sources, like mulberry or kozo, as it's called in Japan, hemp or abaca, which is a type of banana plant. And these are all fibers that have been used in some for many years to make papers, but origami artists had to find the papers made from those fibers, or in some cases, find paper makers who could develop recipes working with those fibers to create the papers suitable for origami.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned, I remember one time, even wrapping paper gave some flexibility that wasn't there before.
Oh, well, when I was a kid, I folded from wrapping paper because it was one of the scrap papers. But most wrapping paper is actually terrible.
Oh, is it?
For origami. It doesn't hold a crease worth beans. Uh-huh. It's really weak and rips easily. So
recycle it?
You know, recycling is great for simple things. I mean, and when I was a kid, I recycled paper. All the paper were obsolete forms that my dad brought home from the office, or wrapping paper left over from Christmas and the like. But you can find better papers than those.
Okay, another question from the audience, which I'm sure is something that you've had to deal with, but also for young origami artists, which is, how the heck do you make a living out of being an origami artist?
That's a tough question, because I sort of fell into it, and it almost feels like living a charmed life, because whenever one form of income dried up, something else came along. But it's managed to do that now for about 15 years, so I feel like it's probably going to continue. I make my living from sales of artwork, art commissioned for commercial art, for advertising, TV, web commercials, print ads, lecturing, workshops, and the last few years, quite a bit of consulting on these NSF-funded university projects and also consulting for various companies that use that realize something in what they're doing requires folding sheets in a non-trivial way. And so that's all those pieces together keep me pretty busy. I have fellow origami artists who do a different mix. My colleague Joseph Wu concentrates almost exclusively on advertising, but he's very good at it and gets most of the advertising business. Other artists teach. I've got a friend who concentrates on writing books and then living off the royalties. So there are multiple ways to make a living. You just have to find out what your niche is and then focus on it.
Right. And it sounds like that's not too unusual for any kind of art, is how you pull together different aspects of either teaching or writing and showing an exhibition and so forth. Yeah. Here's a question from one of the sixth graders in the audience tonight, which is, what inspired you to take on challenging origami pieces? And there was another one that was similar, which is, how do you develop the subject ideas for your origami?
Well, the answer to the first is, I'm going to quote Hillary, it's, you know, because it's there. If I see a neat idea, the challenge of accomplishing it is often enough to make me go after it. But answering more towards the second question, where do I get my inspiration? Very often it's from the natural world. I love nature. I spent my childhood tromping around in the woods and gathering and looking at plants and animals. And I still love nature. And when I'm in the outdoors and I see, you know, a golden eagle flying overhead, or go on some trip and see charismatic megafauna somewhere, I'm inspired. I want to recapture that emotion in folded paper. Mm-hmm. And so I come home, or sometimes while I'm right there, grab paper and start folding.
Speaking of folding, just real quickly, I think you mentioned that you don't, or have you ever had many paper cuts? Mm-hmm. With that much paper around.
Yeah, you'd think handling paper over and over for years, I'd have scars all over.
Yeah, I was looking for calluses.
But in fact, it almost never happens. For the most part, where the types of paper I'm folding and the ways I manipulate just don't set up a paper cut. The very few times I've had is when I've been working on commercial jobs and I have to use really thick paper, like photo backdrop paper, and I'm having to rush. And so that's when I've gotten a few cuts.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that sounds like we should all be doing it then.
Probably less than five times in my whole career.
Wow. Wow, that's amazing. Here's an audience question, and I had the same one, which is, what do you think is kind of the holy grail of origami? What is that big or small thing out there that needs to be done?
Well, for many years, I thought the holy grail was curved folding, but then I folded a curved holy grail, so I got over that. I don't think there is a single...
I felt like that was a softball to you.
Yeah. Yes. I don't think there is a single holy grail, because I don't think there's a stopping point. The artists in origami are going in different directions. It's not a linear progression, it's a radiation outward. And each artist is moving the art and their own presentation and the way they represent shapes in paper in a way that doesn't seem to be running into limits. Mm-hmm. So I just think it will keep growing forever. Mm-hmm. The world of... If I look back, look at what origami is today and what people were doing 10 years ago. 10 years ago, people seeing what they're doing today would have said, that's impossible. But 10 years before that, people would have said, well, that's impossible, what you're doing. And it's been that way for decades. So unlike Moore's Law, which seems to be kind of leveling off, I don't think the exponential growth in the world of origami is leveling off anytime soon.
Mm-hmm. Is there currently in your mind something rolling around about how can I do this to complete that? Is there currently something you're trying to solve?
There's always a bunch, but the one that is rattling around most recently and that I've started noodling on is the idea of making pots that have an inherently helical shape. I have to explain this a little bit. For many years, I've done paper pots inspired by Southwestern pottery, where the lines of the pots travel pretty much vertically from the base up to the top. But I'd like to make the dominant lines of curvature spiral around the pot helically. There are some Southwestern pots that have that sort of pattern. I'd like to do that in paper. Mathematically, it's pretty challenging. So I've been noodling around with the math to do it, but haven't yet hit upon a good solution.
Okay. One of the other questions is a little bit about the future of technology in origami. For instance, today I read about origami techniques being combined in the development of self-folding medical implants, basically flat surfaces that are 3D printed and then taught how to self-fold later. You mentioned several others just a few minutes ago. What could be happening next? That if you were a VC here in Silicon Valley and you were hearing a pitch, what would be something that would get you excited about problem solving for this?
I was all set to answer until you threw out the VC qualifier.
You got to have
fun. Because most of the developments in the area of self-folding, I think, are not yet ready for VC funding. Mm-hmm. And so when you ask, where's the technology going next? One of the big technological problems in applying origami to things is the problem of actuation, how you put the folds in place. I mean, when I'm folding, I take my hands, I grab it, and I manipulate it, and it folds up. And at a university research level, when you make some incredibly productive little folding widget, the way you put it together is you give the pattern to a graduate student and say, go fold this. but for the VC to fund it, you have to have a way of doing that automatically. And what people want to do is to make something that self-folds. So right now, people are developing the technology for self-folding, meaning how do you make creases that, when given a control signal, fold themselves? And the options people explore include arrays of shape memory alloys or gels that swell when you dampen them, or things that bend when you heat them up or shine light on them or apply magnetic fields. But there's still probably some years of university-level research before those technologies will get into production devices, and the VCs will open their wallets.
Thank you for that. You know, I got to say, and I've been looking at the audience, and I see a lot of eyes really kind of opening wide as we've discussed these many variations and these changes and in origami in the future. Let me take you back just for a quick second, because we only have time for about two more questions. But one I just have to ask you about, because it's a time period in origami that was called the Bug Wars. Mm-hmm. What were the Bug Wars? And how did you do? Were you a winner or a loser?
Well, I won't know, because the battles are still going on.
Ah.
The Bug Wars started in the 1990s, and it was all about designing and folding insects. And the reason it came about was, prior to the 1990s, there were almost no single uncut square insects folded from origami, because people didn't know how to do it, things from a single uncut square. But when we started developing these mathematical techniques, we realized we could do something with six legs or eight legs or 10 or whatever we wanted. And so you develop this kind of friendly competition among origami artists, where the field of battle was the most realistic bug. And so one person would do a beetle, the next one would do a beetle with horns, the next one would do a beetle with horns and feathery antenna, and the next one would do a flying beetle, and then a flying beetle whose wings were color changed so that they were white and the rest of it was black and so forth. And these were the Bug Wars, and it went on between probably mostly in Japan, but also myself by proxy because I sent stuff to Japan. And it was friendly. People just tried to one-up each other. Well, that kind of thing still goes on. And so, you know, the latest field of battle is now, can you put the little row of spines down the forearms of a praying mantis, for example? And so it'll never end.
You guys are knuckleheads. Yeah, no.
But spines are important on a praying mantis.
So are the scales on different animals.
That's right.
For my last question, let me ask you about, as you were getting into origami and really becoming a professional after 2000 probably, you were one of the few Westerners who was involved at the time at that particular level. Do you have any experiences about meeting any of the traditional masters? And you said, "Hi, I'm Robert. I'm from California."
I do, and my best experience is actually 10 years before I quit. It was back when I was still into lasers. In fact, I had just come to Silicon Valley and joined this startup, STL. And at this point, the Cuckoo Clock had made quite a splash and even had made sort of a splash around the world. And so I was invited to Japan to attend the Nippon Origami Association's meeting, the first Westerner invited to address their meeting, and so that felt like a big deal. And I was also invited to visit some of the great masters of Japanese origami at that time. And at that time, the masters were all pretty jealous of one another, and it was very formal. Today is quite different, but then it was very formal and structured, and I got to visit the master himself, Akira Yoshizawa, father of modern origami, greatest paper folder in history. And so they brought me to his studio, and of course I dressed up in suit and tie and everything. I wouldn't even do that for y'all, but I did for him. And he pulled out incredible things and showed me, and he kept up a chatter the whole time. He was smiling the whole time, and he kept up a chatter. My interpreter hardly translated anything. And at the end, you know, I thanked, bowed, we left. And I said, "Toshi, you didn't translate any much. What was he saying all that time?" And he said, "Well, most of the time he was chewing you out for various infractions of protocol." And I just felt so it's probably best that he didn't translate. But I did get the last word because Yoshizawa passed away in 1985. In 2012, he was honored by the Google Doodle, and I helped them fold the Google logo to honor Akira Yoshizawa's 101st birthday.
Oh, wow. Kind of tied that on with a bow. That was really nice. So I'm sure all of you feel like you've learned a little more about origami, perhaps, than you had known before. And I want to let you know that if you are interested in more of Robert's work, books, etc., he has a very well-structured website called Lang, L-A-N-G, langorigami.com. And I hope you enjoyed this evening's program, brought to you by the Oshman Family JCC and the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. Again, we would like to thank Robert Lang, origami artist and physicist, our audience here in Palo Alto, and those of you joining on the radio and the web. And now, this meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.